The committee will come to order. We do not have a quorum yet, so, but I think we will start with House File 1341. At least hear testimony. So Representative Knobloch, Chair Knobloch, thank you very much for being here. And when you're ready, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1341 is a bill that the inspiration of which came from me, from Mel Totich, who is here with me today from St. Cloud, Minnesota. And his mother was in one of the nursing homes in St. Cloud, and Mel was paying for her care for roughly the 3.5 years that she was there. She just recently passed away a few months ago. But this was a private pay circumstance, unlike most of the people in nursing homes where you're paying medical assistance. And Mel called me because he was frustrated over the fact that there never seemed to be any consistency about rate increases that he would get. In addition to the rate increases that would happen because of changes in his mother's health situation, the nursing home had the ability to just increase rates anytime they wanted with no notice about the rate increase. And so he would have he would be called in for a health conference and suddenly be told we're raising rates. And this apparently is not a unique circumstance around the state, because as I talked to people, I found that there were quite a few complaints that have apparently come in on this, and the governor was interested, the administration, in doing something about this too. And so House File 1341 is inspired by this, and calls that the governor and the executive branch got as well, where what it basically says is that if you are a new construction nursing home or a nursing home coming off of layaway where you had your beds offline, if you're in a circumstance like that, you can only raise your rates two times a year, January 1st and July 1st. And also, if you're going to be raising rates, you have to, if you're in a different circumstance, if it's just an ongoing situation, you've got to give 30 days notice to raise rates, and you've got to tell people what your rate increase is going to be. Frequently, Mr. Totich was in a situation where he was told that, we gave you a rate increase at the beginning of this month, and we don't even maybe know how much it is yet, but you're going to be getting a bill. And, you know, it just seems to me that for people that are paying rent, it would never work that way in an apartment building or for a home that you're renting, and we shouldn't be having people who are private pay people having to deal with that in our nursing homes either. The one other thing I don't have in here that Mr. Totich may also say a little bit about is the frustration with when you get a increase in a rate because of a health change. You don't know what that rate increase is. You frequently don't find out for some time, and these rate increases can be very significant. But anyway, that's the purpose of House File 1341, and I'd appreciate your support, and I'd introduce Mel Totich to talk about his circumstance.
Thank you. Mr. Totich, thank you for coming, and we're anxious to hear what you have to say. Would you please say your name and identify yourself for the record?
Yes. Mel Totich, 2118 28th Street South, St. Cloud, Minnesota. Anything else you need?
No, that's good. Go ahead and tell us your story.
Okay. As Jim explained, I've had both of my parents in nursing homes the past several years, and I'm not here to change the world, but I think the state had good intentions when they implemented these measures, but I think they're anti-productive for a consumer like me. And so I'm thinking that something has got to be done in order to avoid these situations in the future. In my particular case, I'll give you an example as to how this worked out for me. I'm a snowbird the last 2 or 3 years. I went to Arizona last December. prior to going, I made all kinds, I went the extra mile and then some in preparation for leaving and maintaining my mom's account current. And I was going to do that via the phone with a credit card. Currently, my rent was $5,300 per month at that time. So I left on the 27th of December, and I called in on the 3rd from Arizona of January to pay my bill. My bill increased $2,500 a month at that time. I actually was stranded in Arizona because I just paid my trip and everything on my credit card, and I had a $7,000 max on my credit card, so I was stuck. And I asked for an explanation. I was given none. It said, we changed your rates retroactively last month, and so you owe the $2,000. And I said, whatever. So being in Arizona, I paid it. I ultimately got it paid. I returned. I'm out there January, February, March. I paid my bill in person in April. May, I came back to pay it, and I got another $1,500 increase again. And I quizzed them, and I said, well, they said, well, we changed your rates back on May 11th. And I said, well, why don't you tell me? I said, I can't possibly be facing these $2,000-$3,000 increases without any knowledge. I can't keep doing this. And I did not pay that bill for about 3 or 4 months until I got a hearing with the head of CenterCare Corporation in St. Cloud, because they're the governing body for the nursing home. But all the way up the ladder, I received no help, and everything I ever suggested was blocked. And the reason for it was because of HIPAA laws and whatever. But, okay, the last, every 90 days, there is what they call a care conference. And that's certainly a great idea, and I attended every one, never missed one. In a care conference, all the care staff is assembled in a room with the person responsible for the resident. In this case, it was me. So I attended, and we've got the doctor, we've got the nurses, we've got the therapist, we've got the psychiatrist, nutritionist, everyone. And at that time, we all discuss what the status of the person is. And I've always felt that this would be an opportune time if the person is declining or they're on a steady basis, let me know. But HIPAA laws prohibit those discussions taking place in that room at that time, because I've always said, why don't you tell me what impact these people are having on a financial basis? You know, if she's declining, well, what's it going to cost me next month? But nobody ever did, and they're telling me after I refused to pay that last $1,500 until I got a meeting. And then it was explained to me that all of this staff in the nursing home comprises their data, and it's reduced down to a numerical system. And this is to my understanding, so please bear with me if it's not totally correct, but this is my understanding of how I was told it works. So, and that all was put in place with good intentions so that the nurses and the doctor and all the rest of the staff don't know if this person is on the county or this person is a private pay. So that's all good. But anyway, I lost my train of thought here.
Well, if I can jump in and just say, you know, I think one of the things that happens is, of course, most of the people that we have in nursing homes are paid for by medical assistance. And so we're used to, as the state, you know, the nursing home figures out if they had a decline in their health and maybe they went up to a higher rating, so they've got to be charged more, or they, you know, and they do this not on the first of the month, and they haven't necessarily raised their regular room rates even on the first of the month, but they just, you know, have sent us those bills and we've paid them. And I guess maybe it works that way for the state and medical assistance, but it's a terrible imposition, and really, I think, wrong for those people we do have that are private pay who are paying a lot of money. And Mr. Todd, if I can ask you, I mean, how much money did you pay for your mother at the nursing home in the last year?
I just did the taxes yesterday, and it was $99,000. So, I mean, and these rate increases are $2,000-$3,000 at a time. And, well, that's another point I want to bring up, is because, like in my mom's case, she had Alzheimer's disease, which was a very slow process. I've never been opposed to paying the rate increases. I just want to know about them. In my own case, it took me about 4 to 5 weeks to obtain the funds, even, out of an IRA account. So then, I mean, the nursing home did work with me on that because I wasn't imposed late fees, but certainly could be. But
Mr. Todd, before we go any farther, we have a quorum. So if you don't mind just a second, we'll call this meeting officially to order. And really quick, Representative Lohmer, would you move the minutes for February 15th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Are there any additions, corrections, or changes? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. So then we want to move House File 1341 to be re-referred to Health and Human Services Reform Committee. I will move that. And Mr. Todich and Representative Knobloch, I think we have a couple of questions for you. And Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just getting more intrigued. I don't know if I want to wait for my question until you're finished. And I'm, first of all, very sorry about the loss of your mother. I'm having a hard time getting my head wrapped around a business model in any way, whether it's paid with medical assistance or private pay. I think you're bringing up a point that, do we really know, as your mother's case was, if her health was declining and her needs were greater and she had to have better care, why it was so difficult for you to understand the charges and what each charge was going to be on top of that? I've got to believe that there's safety nets there for that, and so I don't know if there's anybody here that can speak to that later, but I'm just surprised that they have that ability to just, you know, again, and I know some health declines faster than others in some cases, and maybe that takes more money, but I'm just hoping that today we can get an answer for why is that? If that happened to you, I'm going to guess it happened to 1,000 other people in Minnesota, and just I'm just curious as to, you were asking what are these new charges going to be, and you were not able to be told what the charges increases are and why, what justified them. Is that correct?
Mr.
Todich. That is correct.
Okay. And my understanding, Representative Baker, Madam Chair, is that, you know, and many cases, I mean, the nursing home itself doesn't know. They look and they say, okay, well, we've got these various gradations of how people are rated, A through K or whatever it is, and you're on this scale, and they look at a whole bunch of factors to determine where you fit, and they frankly, I think in many cases, send those factors into the state, and the state runs it through their software, and then the state tells them, oh, the bill should be this now, and only after they get that back from the state can they actually tell Mr. Todick how much his new bill is going to be. So the nursing home themselves on site doesn't even know. I wondered if perhaps we could somehow get software out to each of the nursing homes so they could do these calculations themselves and tell someone like Mr. Todick this, but they, because of the way the system is, don't, as I understand it, even know themselves.
Representative Knobloch, I'm a little confused myself because I actually take care of my aunt in the nursing home. And when there's a change of any kind, I'm called right away, personally. If there's a physical change, there's been an accident, she actually fell out of bed while they were caring for her, and I get a call immediately that something's wrong and what I need to do to address it. So I'm a little surprised because when her needs are changed, I'm getting that call, or we talk about it in the care plan meeting, exactly what it is that changes. So I understand that, is Val Cook in the audience here? Would you mind coming up and addressing some of how we do this? Ms. Cook is from DHS, and we'll have her address a little bit of this issue. Thank you for joining us, and will you please identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Valerie Cook, and I'm the Division Director for the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division at the Department of Human Services.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
So I think the first thing I could probably address is this issue of a change in condition and the case mix classification system.
Sure.
So Representative Baker, you asked questions about software for the nursing facilities. And so the way that system works is when approximately every 90 days, everybody is reassessed with the assessment, and it's that assessment is submitted to the Department of Health, who turns around electronically and gives a case mix classification notice back to the nursing facility that's responsible to give that to the responsible party and the resident. Most nursing facilities do have in-house software that probably creates that, but the Department of Health is the actual valid notification that comes back for the resident. And so when those assessments take place, the rate adjustment, if there is a change in the case mix classification because of a change in condition, that rate adjustment is effective the first day of the following month.
Okay. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. I think that was a good answer for the software part of it. If there are increases in rates for folks that go up a certain percentage, like more than 10% at any given time, is there a little red dot that shows up on somebody's software to say, let's take a look at this to make sure this seems reasonable? Maybe it's a different rate. I'm just saying, and I've got a few more other questions too, Madam Chair.
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I don't believe there is any kind of a red flag system based on a percentage of increase between case mix classification groups.
Okay.
Representative Baker.
Madam Chair, and then, so to the testifier's concerns about just not knowing why these rates are going up and what services are we providing now for the extra $1,500 or $2,500, does the family have a right, who are part of the care conference every 90 days, do they have the right to understand the costs, whether it's MA or whether it's private pay? It shouldn't matter. I'm just curious, what protection or what questions can they ask without crossing the HIPAA line?
Ms. Cook.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I am not a HIPAA expert at all, and so I actually made a note of that during the testimony to better understand what the rights are of knowing condition changes. So I would need to get back to the committee on that.
Representative Baker, and I guess my experience has been even when My aunt happens to be MA. Even when her leg broke, we had a conference before we even decided what we were going to do about it, because I was fully aware that the doctor was talking surgery, and I was pretty sure that wasn't going to work because of her condition. And about a few weeks later, they confirmed, or a few days later, they confirmed that, in fact, I was on the right track. But we had that conversation so that we weren't doing things ahead of time. So I'm curious as to, you know, is it different for different nursing homes, or is this, I don't know.
And if I can jump in, Madam Chair, Mr. Todick could correct me. I don't know that Mr. Todick is saying that he wasn't notified as his mother had a change in care. I think it was more of a concern that he never knew how much more money all this was going to cost and was getting suddenly these increases out of the blue, and in fact being told that now you have an increase that's retroactive back to some date that he never even knew about until then.
That's correct. I mean, it was just that the care conferences took place, and I actually brought it up at the earlier care conferences that I said, what impact will this have for the next 90 days so I can plan ahead? And they always was told, well, we can't discuss that because there's HIPAA laws. I said, well, because the doctors were there and so forth, so they can't cross-reference one another. I said, I would certainly meet with every one of you outside individually. They wouldn't do that. No matter what I came up with, I was always met with a brick wall. It's just that the care conferences never coincided with the rate increases. And so, yes, every time the nursing homes were always very prudent in informing me if my mom took a spill or whatever. But that last increase for $1,500, they said, well, we changed the rate May 11th. I said, I just had a care conference 2 days earlier. I said, why didn't you tell me? I said, now I just got to cough up $1,500. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm a landlord. I've been a landlord for 40 years in St. Cloud. I said, I have a receipt that says I'm paid for me. And I said, now you're telling me I owe an additional $1,500. I said, it doesn't work that way to me. I said, I need to be told. So I was fortunate that I was in St. Cloud, but there are a lot of people that come a long ways for these care conferences and so forth, and they need to be informed as well. So, I mean, this happened to me at least three or four times. So, and I never was given an explanation. And what Jim just said, the nursing home wasn't trying to jip me. They just didn't know. And when they came to the bottom line, they said, well, all this is submitted to the state in a numerical fashion, and it inputted into the state, and it comes back. So we actually do not know what the price is going to be.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Baker, did you have another question?
I did, Madam Chair. And again, to his exact point, I guess, to Ms. Cook, do you see nursing homes that are able to go retroactive and go backwards if they don't have a software program on property, or they do either way? Do nursing homes do that very often in your experience?
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, if it's due to a change of condition, it would be unusual for it to be retroactive because, as I said, you know, the rate change would be effective the first of the month following the assessment. I would say it's probably other circumstances where there might be some retroactive rate adjustments due to the complexity of rate setting. So there are situations where a facility might not know exactly what the amount of the rate increase is as they're waiting for the department to determine the rates, but that would be separate. Representative on Oblock talked about those kind of changes due to property rate changes and things like that. But the change of conditions situation should not be retroactive.
Okay. Thank Representative you. Baker? Sorry. Okay. Thank you. Do we have anyone else that has questions? Anyone from the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none, I thank you very much, Mr. Tadish. It's pronounced differently up in my neck of the woods, so I'm having trouble remembering that. And Representative Knobloch, do you have anything to add?
Well, no, thank you. I just, again, appreciate your support, members, and, you know, I think, as I mentioned before, you know, most of the people that are in our nursing homes, we're paying for through medical assistance. But people like Mr. Tadek, who are paying for his mother, who have, over the years, saved the money that he needed to save to pay for his mother in a nursing home. And, you know, the last year, paid over $90,000, had his mother in the nursing home for 3.5 years. I mean, that's a real commitment that someone like Mr. Tadek should be congratulated on following through. And I think that we should make sure that our system runs in a way that it is treating people like Mr. Tadek fairly.
Representative Knobloch, Representative Baker, do you have another?
Just a comment, and because I know you want to close this up, and I support this, but I just think that if it goes on to HHS reform, that we should have somebody there from HIPAA that to maybe ask some of these questions that we weren't able to. That's all, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yep, you bet. We'll make sure we do something about that, because I'm really curious too. I'm sure other members will be. So, well, with that, Representative Knobloch, I thank you very much, and I renew my motion that House File 1341 be referred to Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say no. Motion prevails, and House File 1341 is referred to Health and Human Services.
Can I say one additional thing?
Mr. Tadish.
Yeah, thank you. It's referred to as House Bill this and that. Could it be PAT provision? Called Pat. The PAT provision?
PAT's provision? Is that your mother?
Phyllis and Toddy.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what we can do. We always have to have the House file on there so we keep them straight. We thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for your dedication to your parents. It's commendable.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. With that, Representative Poppy, we're going to move to House File 941. If you'd like to join us. I move that House File 941 be referred to Health and Human Services Reform Committee. We have the bill before us. Go ahead, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you, first of all, for listening to stories. I'm sure that you do this every day, and Mr. Tadish had quite a story, and I think, you know, many of us probably come to the legislature and we carry bills on behalf of constituents. Sometimes we carry bills on behalf of ourselves or our family members, but I think this, especially in your committee, it appears as though you must have a lot of personal connections and personal stories that you can add to what is going on. This is the House File 941 is a story about people with Alzheimer's and the caregivers that provide the support for them. And I appreciate Mr. Tadish thinking about how a bill could be named. When I think about this bill, I think about Russ and Norma, because they're friends of mine, and they have a situation where Russ is getting a little bit less able to take care of himself, and Norma is approximately the same age, and they're on a fixed income and don't have a lot of additional ability to pay for services beyond just, you know, living their day-to-day lives. So this bill is actually designed to help support and sustain the at-home experience for people who are suffering with Alzheimer's or dementia and the caregivers that provide that support. And most often it's family caregivers, and especially in the case of Russ and Norma, it would be a family caregiver. There are programs available throughout the state for a variety of things. You know, in Austin, where I live, we have a daycare center, so people can actually adult daycare. They can go, and but it costs, you know, almost $80 a day, and for some people, that's just not going to be possible to pay for that. Certainly, people can try to experience other services, either have people come in home or otherwise have the ability to do that, either cost-wise or just because they can. This is designed to actually help to provide some respite care in a community setting that would be a very short-term, very abbreviated, but it would provide for those family caregivers especially to be able to have a chance to maybe get away for an hour and a half to take their loved one to a facility. And when I say facility, I mean it could be a church, it could be a school, it could be a senior center, it could be a place where it would be a community respite. They'd be able to bring their loved one there for a short period of time so that they could run and maybe get their hair done or go and get their grocery shopping done or do something that helps them to, because they need to be rejuvenated as well if they're the caregiver in this experience. So the idea is that it would be a support service. It's not the whole fix. We have a problem with Alzheimer's and dementia that's going to overcome a lot of the expenses that you're going to see in medical assistance, certainly because people in nursing homes in the past, maybe they had just some physical needs to take care of. Now they have much more emotional and mental health care needs as well. And that's going to just cost the state more and more money. So if we can try to extend their lives at home for a period of time, even if it's a month or 6 weeks, that's thousands of dollars over the course of the numbers of people that are impacted by Alzheimer's and dementia. So this bill is essentially designed to do that, and it's a small amount of money, $200,000 that I'm requesting, to go to the area agencies on aging so that they could then distribute those dollars. And so it's almost like a pilot project on a statewide scale to be able to have people come to a community respite center and be able to have that relief for a period of time. It's not a lot of money, but it could extend and sustain the people in their homes, and it could help with the caregivers who are providing that care. So that's, I can describe it further, but that's essentially the bill.
Great. And members, do you have any questions? Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sounds like a great idea, a great bill. Thanks for bringing it forward. I'm just trying to get my head around. So the money goes to the agency that would take care of these folks. So if it's your spouse, you can just drop them off, then you don't have to deal with financials or anything. They just are allowed in so much time, or can you kind of explain that a little bit more for
me? Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lohmer. I appreciate that question for clarification. Actually, the money would go to the Area Agency on Aging. What, in my mind, it would go to, perhaps it would go to a community group in a small town that has a community center, a senior center, but they're going to now provide this opportunity, and maybe they'll do it once a week. Maybe that they'll be able to provide some opportunities. Certainly the area agencies on aging, as well as Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Charities, AARP, the Alzheimer's Association, there are lots of resources to provide information about what could be done at the respite site, but it would really be to allow for the person who is the caregiver to not have to pay for this very brief community respite, and then for the people that are providing it to maybe have some money. So it's not a money-making deal for anyone on any part of this, but it's just hopefully enhancing the lives of the caregivers and those that need the care and keeping them home. So it's not like money is necessarily exchanging hands, other than it's going to the Area Agency on Aging, and then they would distribute it perhaps in, again, smaller amounts to people and communities and groups that might be interested in providing that care.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up, so would this be across the state, or do you have a specific area in mind? Or?
Representative Poppe.
Thank you again, Madam Chair and Representative Lohmer. There are 7 area agencies on aging, so they all have a region of the state. So it would be, it wouldn't be a pocket in a certain area, but it would be spread throughout the state. But again, you know, again, for me, I think about, you know, Austin is about 25,000, a little bit more people. We have a adult daycare. We have some other resources that maybe people can pay for. And there might be just a number of people that would, it's a larger city, so you might have more friends or neighbors who could step in and help. But for some small towns, you know, it might be fewer than 1,000 people in a small town. We depend on people in small towns. I grew up in a very small town. We depend on people in small towns to step in and do a lot. They're the volunteer firefighters. They're the ambulance service. They're the people that are doing a lot. So they may be the people that would step forward to do this, but it would provide them a little bit of money, again, to be able to maybe do that, and it might be also training. I guess that was a big piece of it, would be how, because not everybody is familiar with Alzheimer's and dementia, and, so making sure that they, so that people who are there doing the service have an understanding of how to address, how to deal with people who have lost their memory or are in the process of that.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, Representative Lohmer just really asked the question I was going to ask, but I'll just go a little bit more on that. So my thought was just around geographic gaps, mm-hmm. and making sure that there's some intentionality to how the money is allocated to make sure, being from greater Minnesota and mm-hmm. to your point exactly, on smaller towns, that if that is going to be delineated anywhere and how the grants are or the money is given out, to really assess geographic gaps and hit those. So
mm-hmm. thank you.
Thank you. Representative Poppe, I think this is an excellent idea. I would offer the fact that I think this is going to expand. I've got a nursing home talking about trying to figure out how to do respite care for overnight, because as we know, Alzheimer's patients don't always sleep, and so those caregivers sometimes need that break just to get some rest. But I think this is just the tip of the iceberg when we talk about this. Great idea. Do you have any final comments? Excuse me. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Okay. Do you have any final comments then, Representative Poppe?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is a tip of the iceberg, and this is just a very small aspect of what I think could be done, maybe should be done, to help us with this. The big picture is going to be very costly. So thank you.
All right. Thank you for bringing this forward. With that, I will move House File 941 to be re-referred to Health and Human Services Reform. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. And the motion is carried forward. House File 941 will be sent to Health and Human Services Reform. So, all right. So, Representative Poppe, I believe you have another bill that we would like to hear. That would be House File 942. I'll move that to be re-referred to Health and Human Services Reform Committee. Representative Poppe, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is, again, maybe trying to address an issue related to, again, Alzheimer's and dementia. There are kind of a phase of how you can get additional support services in the healthcare system, including essential community supports, alternative care, elderly waiver. And each one of those has a greater number of services that are included in the kinds of services that they provide. And this bill would add 2 things to essential community services, and that would be the companion services and respite care. And it would increase the amount that would be available to people. So it increases it to $600. Again, it's just, I know that there's, I'm sure there's a cost to this, and there's, you know, there may be people in the audience that would have some comments about whether or not this is a good idea or less than a good idea, but I think that whatever we can do to kind of help front load services so that people get that kind of care initially, I think you can, again, extend the person's life within the community, and that reduces the overall cost. And so that's, again, what I'm just thinking about with this bill.
Okay. Members, do we have any questions? Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? Well, seeing none, we'll find out the costs. I'm sure that will work through as we move through the committees. So do you have any other final comments?
No, just again, thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and thank you for listening to the stories, because I think that's really important for you to, you know, I know that many people have an understanding based on their own personal experiences, but you have the opportunity to hear from a lot of people and listen to a lot of stories, and I appreciate the fact that you spend the time to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. With that, members, I will re-refer House File 942 to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. And with that, that will House
thank
File 942. Thank you. We'll head to Health and Human Services Reform. Okay. So we're going to change up just a little bit. I have a testifier that has to leave. So, Representative Tice, would you come join me here? What's that? Okay. I'm going to move the House File 952 to be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. So, with that. I know we have a very full schedule today, so members, we will do this as quickly as possible. But after having a conversation about hearing loss, I'm really concerned about how we work with and take care of not just senior members, but people that do have a hearing loss and the effects that that can have on our quality of life and really taking care of people in general. So, like Representative Poppy said, we all have personal stories, and I have dealt quite a few years already with a mother who has complete deafness in one ear and partial in the other. And I find it interesting, after 20 years of dealing with it, that family members still talk into her bad ear, and they're shocked when she doesn't catch it. It has been a real training. But anyway, today with us we have Dr. DeReuter, that is going to talk about the effects and what we know about hearing loss.
Representative Keel, I'm just going to interrupt you for a
yes.
second. Do you want to, because you have a testifier that's going to leave, do you want to have her testify first, or do you want to have...
Thank you. I forgot about that, and we didn't bring it forward. You come join us. I had intended that to begin with. I'm thankful you reminded me. Have a seat right there. And go right ahead.
Thank you. And
we'll change up the order.
To the committee. We're, as she said, we're changing up the order. So if you would just introduce yourself for the record, continue on with your testimony, please.
All right. Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Mark D. Ryder. I am the Director of Graduate Studies and Clinical Programs in the Department of Speech, Language, Hearing Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Thank you very much for this opportunity. We appreciate Representative Keel helping carry this legislation. I'm a member of the Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Commission that represents Minnesotans with these conditions. This is a 15-member government or governor-appointed commission where we look at hearing loss, we look at policy, and we look at advocacy for people with hearing and deaf-blind and deaf needs. The commission formed a particular task force in 2014 and 15 that lasted for 7 months. This age-related hearing loss task force was comprised of multiple individuals. To give you some examples here, we had healthcare professionals and academics, consumer organizations, state agencies. So we included the Department of Health and Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division of DHS, as well as the Board of Aging. And then there were industry representatives as well. The industry representatives involved industries such as long-term care, as well as the insurance industry. We looked at a lot of research and realized that hearing loss is a critical public health issue in our state. It needs attention, and what I'd like to do is show you a video that will help you understand more about how we got to this point with this bill and just the results of the work of the task force.
If we could just pause for a second. Ms. Young has to take off, so we'd like to hear her testimony first.
Okay. Madam Chairman, or Chairperson, sorry, and Representatives, thank you very much for allowing me to come today. I'm a doctor of audiology. I actually have a private practice just down the road in St. Paul. We've been practicing in St. Paul for 42 years, helping people communicate and connect again with their loved ones. I'm also on the board of Minnesota Academy of Audiology, and I'm here in support of the bill. Every day I go to work, not because I need to help people hear better, but I need to connect people again to communication that they've lost with their loved ones. No one comes to my office and says, I can't hear. They come to my office and say, I'm missing what's being said. I'm not involved anymore. I'm isolating myself from joining into activities and family with loved ones. And my job most of the day is educating people on communication strategies, how to effectively communicate with their loved ones with hearing loss. And I support this bill, and all the audiologists in Minnesota support this bill, because we know that the more caregivers that know how to communicate with people and know how to bring them back into life again and not be isolated, it's better for everyone. It's better for the healthcare providers, it's better for the caregivers, and most importantly, it's better for the residents and the people that suffer from hearing loss. And that's why we of Minnesota Academy of Audiology support this bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions quick before she has to leave? Seeing none. Thank you. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right, Madam Chair, we'll go ahead and show the video. Again, just some of the results of our commission's work, and we're really excited for you to learn a little more.
In the age of commercial spaceflight and instant global communication, it's staggering just how common age-related hearing loss really is.
I got to the place where I would say, well, what did you say?
I began to feel.
We're not seeing it. I know nothing about electronics.
You're not supposed to. Your kids are supposed to.
There we go.
Self-conscious.
and I would be in meetings and I could not hear.
You're not able to socialize and be a part of the group?
And people with hearing loss frequently isolate themselves and they live in this frustration.
You know, I never noticed until I was told I should go in and get it checked.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine.
For people who have hearing loss, insurance rarely covers it and the cost is very high.
There has been a general unawareness among the general public, but also among healthcare professionals of all kinds, about how destructive hearing loss can be. And that's why early detection and early intervention is tremendously important.
Just generally, what brings you in today?
I have trouble.
I think we now understand that hearing loss, it's not a cosmetic condition. It's not, treating it isn't like coloring your hair or getting a facelift. It's a medical condition. Treating it is actually good for your physical and your mental health.
It's not just a personal health issue. It's a public health issue. And here's why.
Baby boomers are turning 65 at the rate of 8,000 a day, which is really an astonishing thought.
The older we become, actually hearing loss becomes more frequent. Oftentimes it's said that there is a lot of wear and tear on our, you know, hearing structures.
It's incredibly impactful for things like cognitive decline, our risk of dementia, falls, even preventing hospitalizations. That we're seeing that hearing loss is linked with all those outcomes very, very strongly.
After arthritis and heart disease, it's the third most common chronic condition affecting older adults. Two out of every three of us will experience it personally once we're in our 70s. And of those, two-thirds have noticeable hearing loss before the age of 60.
Even though it is a usual part of aging, that it's not without consequence. We think it's a series of dominoes. And I mean, the three big dominoes which we sort of hypothesize or guess at right now is it's a few of them. So one is that when you have a hearing loss, right, it's a little bit of a misnomer. It's not so much you can't hear that you can't understand. And the reason for that is your ear is sending a much more garbled signal to your brain. So understand right now that one of the dominoes is that when you can't hear well, then you're constantly putting a load on the brain. The brain is constantly having to dedicate more brain power, per se, more resources to constantly dealing with that degraded sound, right?
And my own work became, you know, so distracted by the effort to hear what was going on in a meeting that I really didn't have time to think about ideas and make contributions in a way that I had been able to earlier when I heard better.
At the same time, in many studies right now, we're seeing that for people who even have a mild hearing loss, that it leads to faster changes in terms of the brain structure, that you're losing parts of the brain which handle sound, but then has cascading effects on other parts of the brain too that handle things like memory and learning.
In one study, adults with mild hearing loss were two times more likely to develop dementia than those without hearing loss. Adults with severe hearing loss were five times more likely. It's true. If you can't hear what's going on, your brain gets smaller, leading to depression, isolation, and even a measurable drop in your IQ.
I find the third domino, like you mentioned before, is the idea of social isolation, that if you can't hear well, that for many people, just suddenly, you're less likely to want to go out and socialize with your friends.
One of the things that happens when you have hearing loss is it gets worse and worse, is that it gets very effortful to go out and, you know, be part of life. People tend to withdraw.
And those subtle effects of social disengagement we know now are incredibly meaningful for maintaining our cognitive and our physical functional health as we age. So we think that those are actually the three mechanistic pathways through which hearing loss can directly lead to adverse health outcomes as we age.
As hearing loss progresses, you do get more uneasy in social and professional situations. But many, many people with hearing loss are under the age of 60. They're still in the workforce. Many people over the age of 60 are still in the workforce.
I left my position as a medical group administrator after 30 years because of my hearing loss. It was difficult to deal with. I think, like everyone with hearing loss, we tried to hide it. And the hard thing about that is you're trying to function in a hearing world, and I started feeling like my employers were thinking I was less intelligent or losing it, so it made my job very difficult.
This is what happened to me. I stopped contributing at meetings because I was never quite sure what I had heard, and I didn't want to answer inappropriately.
Hearing loss really is just the first domino in a much larger chain reaction. And all these dominoes together, they lead to increased health care costs and more medical interventions, all of which have a real impact on families, retirement plans, and state and federal budgets.
If you address the hearing loss early enough with good rehabilitative strategies, using hearing aids, things like that, can you prevent that decline from happening? That's a key question then.
We could delay the onset of dementia by even 1 year down the line. We would cut the incidence of dementia by 15%, which in the year 2025, 2050, is going to make an enormous financial difference.
The 1965 Medicare Act statutorily precludes coverage of hearing aids. And that was written at a time 50 years ago when it probably made sense. They weren't very effective back then. They weren't even necessarily very expensive back then.
Hearing aids these days can easily cost up to $4,000 for a single hearing aid. And since most hearing loss tends to be bilateral in both ears, so that means you need two hearing aids at $4,000 apiece.
In 50 years, though, a lot of things have changed in terms of the cost, in terms of how we know how effective they are for things even just maintaining our daily functioning and improving our quality of life, not to mention hopefully things like dementia. So I think that will cause reevaluation. A bigger issue, I would say, is the current model of hearing healthcare. I mean, the average cost of a pair of hearing aids is usually around anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 nowadays. And there's so much sticker shock with that. If you go see an audiologist cannot be reimbursed for providing any type of rehabilitative services. They can only be reimbursed for providing diagnostics. So no one is incentivized to help the individual patient, individual 65-year-old person, and that's the bitter irony there, is that the structure of the model right now is just not designed to provide what it should be doing.
For me, as an advocate for people with hearing loss, I say, we need to give them whatever is going to work for them at a price that they can afford.
You have to take personal ownership of knowing the issues, of knowing what to do about it, knowing why to do something about it. But at the same time, that has to be supported by a societal governmental infrastructure that allows those resources to be available.
Madam Chair and representatives, you've seen in the video...
Nothing, just keep going.
Oh, thank you. You've seen in the video here that we do have a true healthcare issue, and one of the things we need to be thinking about is the training of those who work with our senior Minnesotans. Are they able to assist people with hearing loss? Are they able to understand their devices? And are they able to adequately communicate with these seniors with hearing loss? And that's what we're looking to do here. The commission has worked closely with the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services Division. They have many materials that are already developed. The commission has developed other videos such as you've seen here. So there are a multitude of training materials already assembled that now just need to be formalized and put together for training. Also, the Student Academy of Audiology at the University of Minnesota is very interested in furthering this educational plan and are willing as a group to put together online training modules as well. So we thank you for your time, and I'll turn things over to you here.
Thank you, Dr. DeRoy. DeRoyter. Chair Keel, who do you want to call up next then? Would you just like to go down the list?
Yes, let's do
okay.
that. Do we have members that have questions?
Oh, Representative Freiberg.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. If this is the appropriate time for questions on the bill, just had a couple. Well, first of all, thanks for bringing the bill. I remember a year or two ago there was a training or just a presentation given for legislators, and I remember Dr. Lynn, who was in the video from Johns Hopkins, was actually here talking about it, and that was the first time I'd heard of some of the studies about hearing loss potentially being one of the contributing factors to dementia. So this is an important issue to address, and I think the bill fills a need of training of staff on working with people, because I don't know that everybody knows about that and knows what the symptoms are, knows that it can lead towards dementia. I was just wondering, I don't see anything in the text of the bill. You know, it just says that supervisors have to have 2 hours of training on health impacts and information related to hearing loss. I don't see any standards for the training or anything like that? I mean, is there an accreditation body or something for, or something that could be put in here just to make sure that the training that these people have to go through meets certain requirements or certain minimal standards?
Dr. Gerard?
Thank you, Representative. At this point, there is not a particular accrediting body for this type of training. There certainly are accrediting bodies for those who are becoming audiologists, those programs. So there are several accrediting bodies, but not for this specific type of training.
I think maybe at sure, this yeah. point it would be great to hear from our other testifiers.
Okay.
And
and I know Aaron Bowie is standing, so. And Libby? As well? Thank you, Ms. Bowie. If you could just state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Sure. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Aaron Bowie. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Care Providers of Minnesota, here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. We've been having conversations with the proponents of the bill and the bill author. We do have some concerns with the way the bill is currently structured and the additional mandated training required by it. But we are working with them to address those concerns and will continue to do so as it moves through the process.
Thank you, Ms. Bowie. And I'm sure I'm not going to say your name correctly. So, Ms. Chaperin?
Yeah.
You got it. Hey! Bonus for me today.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Libby Chaperin. I'm with Leading Age Minnesota. I agree with what Aaron said. I just want to reiterate that we welcome additional training. Our members want additional training on hearing loss. The issues are more just how it's implemented in this particular bill. So we'll work with Representative Keel and the supporters of this bill to make sure our members get that training in the appropriate manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chaperin. Representative Baker.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the testifier. Other bills and ideas that have been floating around through this committee and other committees like to really strongly suggest certain training of certain things. My idea would be an opioid thing for doctors. So I think this is sort of in the same parameter of what Representative Keel wants to do with this, because I can really support this. I think it's an important thing. You're working through it. Do you have some suggestions for the committee as to what you could work with Representative Keel with on this? Do you have a suggestion that has been offered yet to the author or not?
Ms. Chaperin.
Of training.
Madam Chair, Representative, at this time, where the problem lies is where it's implemented. It's implemented in the Housing with Services statute. This may be more appropriate in the care provider statute instead. We just want to make sure we're training the right people in the right place. In the Housing with Services statute, that person may just be a landlord. So we just want to make sure the right people are getting the right training.
Okay. Ms. Boyd, do you want to add something to that? You look like you wanted to. Okay. Any further questions? Representative Freiberg.
Thanks. Just to follow up on my question from before, too. Starting on line 2.1, it mentions that staff who do not provide direct care, including maintenance, housekeeping, and food service staff, must have at least 1 hour of initial training related to hearing loss. I'm just wondering, why it would be necessary for maintenance staff, housekeeping staff, to have training in hearing loss.
Chair Keel?
Thank you. And let's talk about that just a little bit. I know we need to get going because we've got a couple of other bills we have to do yet. They interact. My experience often with the staff that is around in the nursing home are the ones that, say, housekeeping comes in and asks you how you want something done, wants to know if you need something fixed. And those people need to be able to communicate with a hard of hearing person. It's really important. My experience, this happens to be hospital, but
my aunt was not well and in the hospital and doesn't hear well, doesn't see well. And the nurse was just going to wash her face after she had had something to eat. And she, while she was going to wash her face, she was telling her she was going to wash her face. So the washcloth came at her face while she was also being told, well, when you can't hear and you don't see, all of that is too much. So consequently, what did she do? She struck out. And the nurse was far enough away she didn't get hit. But that's part of our problem with aggressiveness is that seniors, especially in nursing homes, do not understand what's happening to them. And so that is the other thing is a janitor might just be coming in to fix something and they might think that it's their house and someone is in stealing from them. And so that importance of communicating, not just letting them know that they're in there to do something, but how they do it also. I have a nephew that's an Iraqi veteran, and you can still see the effects of that. So he comes to talk to Grandma and talks a mile a minute, and my mother's like, I think I caught the first word. And so trying to train family to say, just slow up a bit so that she can understand the words as they're coming at her is really important because she wants that relationship, but it's hard. And I don't think we as just general citizens understand we're in such a fast-paced world that, you know, we're doing things so fast that this is really hard for people that have hard of hearing problems. So,
and I'm going to add my two cents and we're through. My husband wears two hearing aids. If he doesn't have them in, I know that I have to look at him. He'll say, you got to look at him. And I always think of the little kid who grabbed your face because you're not paying attention. And that's what it is. It's making sure you're looking at him. So when a maintenance person comes in, you don't back in and talk to the hallway. You know, you got to look at them and make sure that, number one, they have your attention, but just so that they can see that too. You don't walk into the closet and talk to them when they're not in the closet. You know, that type of thing. And so it really is just common sense things to do when you're talking to someone who doesn't hear well. So, you know, it probably is just very basic training. Dr. DeReuter.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll just add also personal safety and emergency situations where there can be an all-hands-on-deck with staff who need to communicate with these residents for what needs to be done next.
Thank you. And with that, is there anyone in the audience? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, just briefly. And I agree that the general awareness, increased awareness about the communication strategies, and I know we don't have time to go into that to provide examples, but I just wanted to say that it's good to see that the stakeholders here are willing to work with Representative to work on this bill. Because I think there could be different levels of training, whether it's online or even just watching a video. I mean, but I think it's important to determine who's going to, there may be costs involved in developing that training or who's going to be responsible for that. So, thank you.
All right. Any more questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Keel, in this training, can this be done at the facility or do they have to go to an off-site location for the half-hour training?
I think there are some ideas, possibly maybe online, things that would help our nursing homes not to be overburdened by training already that they have to do. So we need to fine-tune this absolutely and talk about exactly how this is affecting. And there's some ideas that have come up recently. Knowing the deadline on this committee, I ask that we just have this conversation. So.
Representative McDonald? Good. All right. Any further questions? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? With that, any final comments, Chair Keough?
No, I thank you very much for the conversation, and please support the bill.
With that, Chair Keough renews her motion that House File 952 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed, and House File 952 is re-referred. Okay. And while Representative and Chair Schumacher is making his way down here, I would like to move that House File 1115 be referred to the Committee of Health and Human Services Reform. We have the bill before us. Representative and Chair Schumacher is coming down.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And as my testifiers make their way down, I will just give my brief remarks to introduce the bill for you here today. Thank you for hearing House File 115. This bill is an attempt to alleviate the backlog of the psych patients that hospitals are experiencing because of the lack of beds in longer-term treatment facilities such as the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and the seven community behavioral health hospitals in Minnesota. We need more placement options for patients with mental health complications and concurrent medical problems that prohibit their placement into regular community facilities. This especially includes patients who need nursing home level of medical care, but present a challenge to these facilities due to the lack of security to keep this type of patient population separate from their current patient population. This bill pilots 50 beds throughout the state that allows a skilled nursing facility to apply for an exemption to the nursing home moratorium and partner with hospitals to serve this patient population that at times are confined to hospitals for hundreds of days, which is not the appropriate level of care and is a more restrictive environment. These skilled nursing facilities would receive double their usual reimbursement rates to serve this patient population. The reason that we went to double it was that facilities will have to do capital improvements for security reasons and to ensure adequate staffing. With me today, I have Dr. Ian Haith with Hennepin County Medical Center, who will talk about the hospital's struggles to find appropriate treatment facilities and how they believe this could help HCMC and other hospitals. And we also have Jay Peisinger with Augustana Care, a skilled nursing facility which is interested in partnering with HCMC to treat this patient population.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Which gentleman would like to go first?
I believe I am.
Okay, go right ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Certainly. My name is Ian Heath. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify. I'm Ian Heath. I'm the Senior Physician Director for the Psychiatry Service Line at Hennepin County Medical Center. A little bit of self-disclosure. I'm actually a forensic psychiatrist. I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but there you have it. And I worked for the state at the Minnesota Security Hospital for 7 years prior to starting at Hennepin County Medical Center, where I've been for 10 years. I'm here to inform the committee of the difficulties that HCMC faces, secondary to the lack of bed availability at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which in itself relates to DHS policies, the passage of the 48-hour rule. I want to recognize the difficulties that DHS faces. They are in a crunch, so I want to recognize that. As the committee is aware, we are a state mental health system. We used to have a number of regional treatment centers with rather large capacity. And we also had a state nursing home at Agua Ching. To replace those, the state brought online what was to be 10 community behavioral health hospitals. These were brand new construction, 16-bed facilities to provide a longer-term treatment option for those afflicted with severe mental illness. For a number of reasons, the CBHHs have not run at capacity. Because of their small size and small complement of staff, they're unable to handle more complex patients, more medically complex patients, and more aggressive patients. This has resulted in those facilities, which are dispersed around the state, in referring these cases to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. That means that fewer beds are available at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center for the metro hospitals to send patients to. On top of that, the state is running the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center at around 100 beds. They're licensed for 175. Compounding this, in 2013, the 48-hour rule was enacted, which compels DHS to accept patients who are civilly committed from jails within 48 hours. Back then, this was 2013, back then the state set aside 4 beds at Anoka for this population. You know, hindsight is what it is, but it's clear that this was inadequate, and I think these days probably half or if not more of the patients at Anoka came there from jails. So the consequence to the Metro hospitals, and I think it's beautifully illustrated by what's occurred at HCMC, in 2009, for example, we sent 87 patients to the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. In 2014, we were down to 28. 2015, we hit 5. And 2016 was 6. That's it. So in essence, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center is not available to the metro hospitals, which it was originally intended to serve. As a consequence, patients, those typically afflicted with severe mental illness, chemical dependency, medical comorbidities, and oftentimes or sometimes with a history of violence, remain in an acute care, highly expensive, restrictive setting for extended periods of time. So it's not unusual for us to have patients at Hampton County Medical Center for 100, 150, 200 days. And the issue is they may have reached their maximal benefit from an acute care facility such as Hennepin County Medical Center, yet there is nowhere to transfer their care to. These patients can't be released to the community as there's no facility that will accept them or is secure enough to accept them. There's no bed at Anoka for us to send patients to. And we're seeing a subset of this group of individuals who have come to us with prior mental health histories, but also undergoing dementing processes. With that, of course, with the age that people undergo those types of processes, they also have more medical comorbidities. Due to the inability to discharge the patients, of course, our beds remain occupied, and then we see a domino effect where we're very fortunate at HCMC. We have a bespoke psychiatric emergency room, but that only has a 16-bed capacity. So that becomes filled up. Then we overflow into part of the emergency room that's dedicated to sobering individuals, and then that overfills into the main emergency department. So you can imagine this becomes a large patient flow issue within the entire facility, not just even in psychiatry. One of the big issues we have, of course, is the inability to get people into the community. And we lack community placements, long-term living facilities, and nursing home facilities who are willing or able to manage complex medical patients afflicted with mental illness and dementia. We're unable to place the patient in the right setting at the right time in what would be a more fiscally prudent fashion. We have begun initial meetings with Augustana to try and facilitate bringing online some beds in that facility to try and manage these more complex patients. We're thankful to Representative Schumacher for authoring House File 1115, a bill that would address an existing patient flow issue. I want to state that HCMC is dedicated to attempting to solve this problem with DHS and other healthcare systems to improve care for our patients. At this point, I'll turn it over to Mr. Peisinger.
Thank you, Mr. Peisinger. Welcome. And would you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jay Peisinger. I'm a regional director of campus operations at Augustana. We have a facility right across the street from Hennepin County Medical Center, so the geography really makes sense for us to want to do this pilot. We'd like to collaborate with HCMC to serve persons with major disorders of thought, mood, and cognition, and whose disorders are concurrent with medical diagnosis or aggressive behaviors that are unable to care for themselves and require nursing home level of care. We do serve some mental health patients in the facility at the moment. This would be definitely a step up for us, and we do like the idea of a pilot. For us to do this, though, we need legislation to pass that would provide a rate increase to remodel, increase staffing levels, train our staff in this area, and also to hire various specialists. We have 22 beds at that facility on layaway, so they could be brought back into service. We have two empty units not in service. One has 17 beds available, and we would think we could probably serve 13 patients in that area. We would use this money. Right now we have staffing ratio for the licensed nursing of about one nurse for 30 patients. For this, we would do one nurse for 15 patients. For nursing assistants, we're pretty close to where we need to be. We're serving about 10 residents. We'd want to staff to a 1-to-8 ratio. I'd already said we would be looking at some training and consultation services, but we'd also would need some additional security and then capital improvements for private treatment rooms, secured spaces, and residence rooms. So, and we also would look forward to working with Hennepin County Medical Center so they can provide outpatient psychiatric services and medication management for us. So I'd like to just thank you for your consideration of the legislation to help us serve patients who need the long-term care needs and with mental health needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Baker, you have a question?
Madam Chair, I might have missed this at the front of the presentation. My apologies. Is there sort of a waiting list right now? If there was a need, or does the department or HCMC have a sort of like, we have 10 or 15 on the waiting list right now if the rooms were available, but don't? I'm just kind of curious if that is something that actually exists. Thank you.
Dr. Heath.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
We don't have specifically have a list, but, yeah, absolutely, we have patients currently in the hospital who would benefit from nursing home level of care, but they need to be in a more secure setting with an increased complement of staff to be able to care for them in a safe fashion. Keep in mind, we're solely one hospital. There are many other hospitals, and this would be, I believe, a more statewide type of pilot. We happen to have the luxury of having Augustana very close to us, and so this would be one part of it, and maybe illustrative of the collaboration that we would choose to undertake.
Representative Baker? Okay. Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Pazinger. Is that correct? So you're asking for the bill, according to Representative Schumacher, is a rate increase. And is that for the 1 for 15? And then what is the what is the rate right now for your staffing ratio 1 in 30?
Mr. Pazinger. Pazinger. There we go.
Thank you. Pazinger.
Pazinger. There we go.
Right now we are at $96 a day. And so with the math, that would just basically double. And then the annual amount would be approximately $35,000 a year to care for the patient. So that $35,000 would cover the cost that I was discussing that I listed out.
Thank you. Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so about $35,000 a year for that patient. Mm-hmm. And will they be in the facility for a year? Is that an average length of stay, or I would presume not, but perhaps I'm wrong.
I think it would be pretty based on their comorbid conditions. Some it may be a longer term type placement, others it may not. I think every case is different.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do recognize and understand the concern in the area. You have patients that are discharged from the hospital. They have mental health issues and cognitive issues. Where do you place them? You know, back in the street and then go back in the jail and then back in the hospital. So it is a serious problem, and this is a great solution, expensive one, albeit, but probably less expensive than putting them back on the street. So why the need for doubling? Is it just that level of acute care is necessary, that it the rate needs to be doubled for this particular patient?
Mr. Heath?
Principally, I think, to hire more staff, because this is a patient population where you may go in to try and do cares on the patient, and they may strike out. We heard earlier about how people misperceive and whatnot. So what you're attempting to do, I believe, is increase the staff presence so that you can do the cares in a safe fashion, as opposed to putting someone in to a room with a patient who may strike out. And, of course, we've seen, unfortunately, a number of assaults at Anoka have skyrocketed and whatnot. We've heard testimony about that before in the past. So this is attempting to provide a safer means for them to provide care in a nursing home setting, which would be more appropriate for the patient.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That makes perfect sense, especially with the staffing ratio of 1 of 15 is proposed. It shows you the patient's behavior and the necessity for for added staff because you're dealing with a patient that is potentially dangerous. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is around why a rate increase versus a direct appropriation for this. And then secondly, speaking a little bit to, it's a pilot project, but we're, you know, reading the bill and understanding some of the language, I was looking for an evaluation component or a learnings or something that, like, what makes this a pilot other than sort of the scope of it? So could you speak to both the I guess there's two questions there. Thank you.
Mr. Bazinger or? Where?
I can only speak for the point of view of kind of our industry of how we would work with this. So my thinking is narrow in mm-hmm. that we work in a rate environment. So this is just basically taking our rate and just increasing other care. Direct care and other care. And so without really knowing, as you said, there's nothing demonstrated about where this will go. I think that would be the approach I would take, is just take kind of our base of knowledge and say, in this case, say it costs us a total of $250 a day to take care of a resident with low mental health needs. And when this was proposed, we sat down and looked at the staffing and said, with the addition, this should probably get us there in kind of our rate environment. So that would be kind of my best suggestion would be that.
All right. Madam Chair.
Yes.
And
Representative Schumacher.
Representative Keel, Representative Olson. I probably misspoke when I talked about it being more of a pilot project. It wasn't intended to be a pilot project like we think about pilot projects being, not something that we test here and then expand. This would already be offered statewide. It's just opening up beds. It's bringing the moratorium exception into place so that we are able to offer these beds for this other service. And so there isn't really the testing there. It's just we know we have these beds available. We know that we can get the staff into these beds. We know that these people aren't being treated and getting the care that they need in the setting they're in now, and just bringing that to that. And so I apologize. I shouldn't have called it a pilot project there. Definitely, we know what we're going to get with this.
Okay. Representative Olton? Okay. I'm curious. Explain to me, can you mix the populations of just the general clients that you serve plus the mental health clients?
My answer would be no.
Expand on that a little bit?
Well, without having served this particular population, it's just kind of more the anecdotal stories of what we think we'd be facing. And with the moods and behaviors, there may have to be some security restriction of how they'd interact with the general population. But again, that's part of what we'll call, in my words, the experiment or the pilot to see if we can integrate them in a facility that's got 230 other residents. So I'm just saying that initially, and as we go along, maybe we very well could. But I would kind of defer to the expert here on that one as far as integrating with the rest of the population.
Dr. Heath?
I think the idea is originally to not integrate, but it's certainly possible if somebody improves to the extent that they don't need that level of staffing, then certainly there's no reason why they couldn't go to the other part of the facility. Mm-hmm. I think that would be kind of how we would initially approach it. Originally no, but in the long run, potentially.
Sure. It kind of makes sense with look at how we had nursing homes with people that had dementia, and then we decided that they would be better off and safer in a specific unit.
Right.
So it kind of follows that. Sure. Is there any other questions? Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none, Representative Schumacher?
Take it away.
So, well, where are we at? Oh, yes. I'm just kidding. I'll renew my motion that House File 115 be referred to the Committee on Human Services, Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails, and House File 115 is re-referred.
Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you.
Representative Schumacher, I believe you have House File 1353. I don't have it in front of me right now. But, and you have an aid to author's amendment that you would like to pass?
Yes, Madam Chair, if you would please move that amendment.
I will move House File A2 from, House File 1353 A2 to be referred to Committee on Health and Human Services. Oh, I just want to pass the amendment. Rookies. All right. Representative Schumacher, to your amendment.
Right. So to the amendment, to the overall bill, 2 years ago we did the value-based reimbursement. We did a lot of changes to the overall rate setting methodology for nursing homes. Also within that, we had established a recodification process so that we could bring new statute in, clean the language up so that it was brought up to date and that it was easier to follow so that administrators could even go in and look at the statute and understand how things were moving. We, the nonpartisan staff, the staff at DHS, spent, and the stakeholders spent about 7 to 12 months really working very hard to get this. They got their own chapter and statute, which I know they're very excited about, and just trying to get everything along the way that it made the most sense. And there was a little bit of cleanup after that that didn't make it into the original recodification. It was found out by our own house research over the last couple of months that there was some obsolete language and some cross-references that weren't originally in there. And so this is just simply cleaning that up a little bit further and making sure that we have the references as they should be and the obsolete language removed.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Schumacher, to your bill is amended.
That is it, Madam Chair.
Well, you have at least a couple minutes. No. Is there any other questions? Is there any other questions from members at all? And is there anyone from the audience that would like to testify? Well, with that, I guess Representative Schumacher, we are. I will renew my motion that. Do you want have any final words?
Not a one.
I shouldn't have assumed that, but yes. I renew my motion that House File 1353 be as amended be referred to Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say no. Motion prevails, and House File 1353 as amended is referred.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Well, that with members, we are done as our deadline is this week, and it is a possibility that we might do some conversations later on if there is something that you would have interest in. I don't think we're going to have much time because Chair Schumacher is chuckling at me, but I think he is going to be taking up some of Wednesday mornings from 8:15 to 10. So look for that in your schedules and communication. But with that, I thank you all for contributing and being here. And with that, we will adjourn.